Alright, folks, welcome back to On the Trail of the Assassins by Jim Garrison. We're moving on to part 4 of this series, which corresponds with chapter 7 of the book. And chapter 7 is entitled The Front Page. We had identified the once mysterious Clay Bertrand. Now, for a change, we had a period of calm. Here in New Orleans, the usual crimes were being committed, night and day. Despite the syndrome that comes with the job, the feeling that the faster you convict burglars and armed robbers, the faster new ones appear to take their places, the main work of the district attorney's office, the prosecution machinery, had to be maintained and improved. I let the members of the team go back to their regular office positions for a while, and I resumed mine. At night and on weekends, however, I continued my study of the available evidence. Alone in the office or at home surrounded by my family, I would stay up until the early hours of the morning, obsessively poring through testimony, looking for connections and contradictions, thinking, always thinking. The gunfire coming from in front of the presidential limousine had satisfied me that Lee Oswald was not the lone killer of John Kennedy. The admission note at Parkland Hospital, signed by Dr. Robert McClelland, described the cause of death as a, quote, massive head and brain injury from a gunshot wound of the left temple, a location customarily accepted as being in the front of one's head. And yet it was unanimously acknowledged that at the time of the shooting, Oswald was in the school book depository, well to the president's rear. I began to wonder, had Oswald actually shot the president at all? I studied the statements of witnesses who claimed to have observed unusual activity in the book depository and other buildings clustered behind the president. The more I read, the more my doubts grew. About 15 minutes before the motorcade arrived, Arnold Rowland, a student, and his wife, Barbara, were standing on Houston Street across from Dealey Plaza. Arnold had glanced up at the school book depository and at the easternmost end of the sixth floor, where the alleged assassin's lair was located. He noticed a dark-skinned man whom he described as an elderly Negro. However, at the westernmost end of the sixth floor, the opposite end of the building, he saw a man standing just back from the window with a rifle in his hands. The man was holding the rifle barrel pointing upwards at the 45-degree angle which the military describes as port arms. Barbara Rowland, at that moment, was preoccupied by a man having an epileptic seizure in the plaza directly across from them. By the time Arnold got his wife's attention and she looked up, the man with the rifle had stepped away. Now, there's an author's note here. Let me read this. In her testimony in a commission deposition, Mrs. Rowland recalled her husband telling her about the man with the rifle at the depository sixth-floor window. She recalled that it was the westernmost window which her husband had pointed out to her. She did not look up at the windows again, nor did she remember anything about the second man on the floor. Back to the text. They both concluded that the man with the rifle was a Secret Service agent. Arnold testified that on the following day, when he described the presence of the second dark-skinned man on the sixth floor to FBI agents, they told me it didn't have any bearing or such on the case right then. In fact, they just the same as told me to forget it now. Carolyn Walther, employed at the nearby Daltex building, also was standing on the east side of Houston Street. According to a statement she gave to the FBI, Walther watched the ambulance arrive for the seizure victim and happened to glance toward the depository, where she saw a man with a rifle on one of the upper floors. The rifleman was holding the gun with the barrel pointed downward as he looked toward the oncoming motorcade on Houston Street. Mrs. Walther said that the rifle was different from any she had ever seen and had an unusually short barrel. The man holding it was wearing a white shirt and was either blonde or had light-colored hair. He was standing in the middle of the most easterly window on the floor, leaning forward. In the same window, just to his left, she could see another man standing erect. He happened to be wearing a brown suit. Then the motorcade arrived and drew her attention. It did not occur to her to glance up at the window again, not even after the shooting began. She was not called to testify by the Warren Commission. Tony Henderson of Dallas was waiting for the parade on the east side of Elm near the corner of Houston. After the ambulance departed with the epileptic, she glanced toward the depository. She recalled that numerous people on different floors were at the windows looking out. Then, on one of the upper floors, she noticed two men. They were standing in the back of the window and looking out of it at the motorcade. One, a dark-haired man in a white shirt, was dark-skinned and possibly a Mexican, but could have been a Negro. She testified, Mrs. Henderson was unable to describe the other man, except that he was the taller of the two. She did not know exactly which floor the two men were on. The FBI report of her statement did not identify the windows in which she saw the two men. These statements from witnesses who saw two men on the depository's top floor were troubling enough, but one night when I came across the testimony of 16-year-old Amos Ewens, I was so disturbed that I could not sleep. Testifying before the Warren Commission, Ewens described having waved at the president as the long convertible made its leftward 120-degree turn onto Elm. He happened to glance upward at the book depository and saw what appeared to be a pipe sticking out of a window. Earlier, when interviewed by Sergeant D.V. Harkness of the Dallas Police, Ewens had described the window as being the easternmost one on the floor, quote, under the ledge, which is the building's famous sixth floor. After the shooting began, Ewens was able to see the trigger and the stock of the rifle. He had also noticed that the man doing the shooting had a distinct bald spot on his head. Ewens described the bald area as going back about 2.5 inches from the hairline and standing out, as if it were white in the relative darkness of his surroundings. Immediately after the assassination, he described the man as being black. Later in his commission testimony, Ewens indicated that he could not be certain whether the man was white or Negro. However, he was immovable on two points. The first was his insistence that the man definitely had a bald spot on his head. The second was his denial that he had told a sheriff's deputy that the man he saw on the sixth floor was white. What he had said, he explained to the members of the commission, was that the bald spot on the man's head looked like it was white. Considering that Ewens was standing just south of the depository at approximately 12:30, the sun would have been almost overhead and the bald spot of a man leaning forward might well have appeared to be white, I thought. In any case, Ewens' observations of an apparently dark-skinned man with a bald spot on his head seemed to coincide with Arnold Rowland's observation of an elderly Negro. In each instance, the object of their attention was occupying the easternmost window in the depository, which would be the assassin's lair where Oswald was supposed to have been when the parade arrived. Here's an author's note. Let me read this. The greatest view by far of the depository's sixth floor was from the county jail on Houston Street. The inmates had clustered at the windows to see the presidential motorcade. Stanley Kaufman, an attorney who testified before the Warren Commission, described a client of his, Willie Mitchell, as not having seen anyone when he glanced over at that window. However, Kaufman went on to say that there were people in jail who saw the actual killing. The inmates of the jail were not called to testify by the Warren Commission, nor were they questioned by the FBI or the Secret Service. However, one of the inmates, John Powell, surfaced later. Powell, who was in jail for only several days on misdemeanor charges, did not thrust himself forward to testify. Rather, he simply informed acquaintances of what he had seen on the depository's sixth floor. Ultimately, one of them contacted the media. Powell and his fellow inmates were on the sixth floor of the jail, so they were able to look right into the sixth floor of the depository several hundred feet away. A few minutes before the assassination, Powell and the other inmates stared from their window into the window just across the way and watched two men with a rifle. At first, they thought that the two were security guards until the shooting began. Powell recalled that one of the two men had a very dark complexion. Back to the text. And both of their statements seemed to be supported by Tony Henderson's conclusion that the man she had seen was either a Mexican or a Negro. Two other men, each of whom was considerably more observant than the average witness, helped to unify the collective observations of the foregoing witnesses into a comprehensive picture of who was on the sixth floor just before and during the shooting of the president. Roger Craig, honored in 1960 for his performance as a Dallas deputy sheriff, remembered that a few minutes after the assassination, he observed the Dallas police questioning a Latin man on Elm Street. As Craig recalled it, the police, frustrated when the man did not answer their questions because he could not speak English, released him. Some minutes afterwards, Craig saw a Nash Rambler station wagon pull up in front of the depository and recognized the driver as the Latin man who had been released by the police. Before he could do anything, a young white man, whom Craig later identified as Lee Oswald, came running down in front of the depository, jumped in, and the station wagon tore off. Now, there's an author's note here. Let me read this. After a few months, after I had read this testimony, or his testimony, rather, Craig came to see me in New Orleans. An alert and idealistic young man who looked more like a cheerleader than a deputy sheriff, Craig had been driven out of Dallas by the law enforcement establishment. His honest testimony had doomed his law enforcement career, and he had decided to leave Dallas after someone took a shot at him, grazing his scalp. I got him a job at the Willard Robertson Volkswagen Company, and Craig met frequently with me, reviewing in detail what he had seen at Dealey Plaza and at Dallas Police Headquarters after the assassination. Shortly after he learned that a suspect had been arrested, Craig told me he went straight to the Dallas Police Headquarters to see if he could help the Homicide Department with the identification. He told Captain Will Fritz, the head of Homicide who was running the investigation, about the Nash Rambler incident he had seen. The two of them then went into Fritz's private office, where Oswald was sitting. Fritz pointed at Craig and told Oswald, "This man saw you leave." Oswald replied, "I told you people I did." Fritz told Oswald to take it easy, that he was just trying to find out what happened. Then Fritz said, "What about the car?" Oswald answered, "That station wagon belongs to Mrs. Payne. Don't try to tie her into this." Later, Deputy Sheriff Buddy Walters drove out to the Payne residence in the suburb of Irving and confirmed that Mrs. Ruth Payne did have a Nash Rambler station wagon with a luggage rack on top, as Craig had observed. There is no record that Captain Fritz or any other members of the Dallas Homicide Unit ever followed up this lead. In fact, Fritz later denied that Craig had been at police headquarters or had told him about the Nash Rambler. However, a news photo that turned up 6 years after the assassination and the autobiography of Dallas Police Chief Jesse Curry clearly shows Craig at the police headquarters, corroborating Craig's story. Okay, that was a long author's note. Let's get back to it here. Let me read the last sentence of the text before we jump before we went into the author's note. Before he could do anything, a young white man, whom Craig later identified as Lee Oswald, came running down from in front of the depository, jumped in, and the station wagon tore off. On this occasion, seeing the Latin man for the second time and in a more inculpatory situation, Craig got a closer look at him. He described the man as not merely being dark-skinned, but a Negro. Meanwhile, Richard Randolph Carr had observed a white man on the sixth floor of the depository, only in this instance at the next westward window from the assassin's lair. Carr, who also saw activity on the knoll, was a steel worker on the upper part of the new courthouse building under construction at the corner of Houston and Commerce. When the shots were fired, Carr, a combat vet, glanced over at the depository. Minutes later, Carr was standing on the ground near the depository when he recognized the very man he had seen earlier at the depository window on the upper floor. Carr described this man as being a heavy-set individual with horn-rimmed glasses and a tan sport jacket. Carr followed the man for a block. The man then climbed into a Nash Rambler station wagon, apparently the same car described by Roger Craig, which seemed to be waiting for him, and the car rapidly drove off. Like Craig, Carr noted in several statements to law enforcement officers that the driver was real dark-complected, either Spanish or Cuban. It seemed fair to conclude from all the statements that a composite visualization of the depository's sixth floor just before and during the assassination added up to at least three different men. Two white, one of whom was apparently youngish and either slightly blonde or with light brown hair, and the other heavy-set with horn-rimmed glasses, and one distinctly dark complexioned, very possible of Latin origin. Whether they had one rifle or two was unclear. The youngish, thinner white man was seen holding one while he stood back of the westernmost window at the opposite end of the assassin's lair, whereas the dark complexion man was seen firing directly from the easternmost lair. After reading the statements of these eyewitnesses, I knew that Lee Oswald could not have shot John Kennedy from the assassin's lair, as the Warren Commission claimed. Unlike the man who was observed shooting from the lair, Oswald did not have a bald spot, nor was he dark-skinned or Spanish-looking. In my mind, at this point, it was still possible that Oswald was somehow involved in the assassination, but it seemed clear that others had participated in the shooting, both from the grassy knoll in front of the president and from the book depository behind him. The appearance and reappearance of dark-skinned, Spanish-looking, or Negro men in the descriptions of the witnesses intrigued me. Not only was the man in the lair identified this way, but the epileptic observed in Dealey Plaza was described as a Latin man wearing army green combat garb. There's an author's note here. Let me read this. The incident involving the epileptic, who had a seizure shortly before the arrival of the president's motorcade, aroused suspicion on several counts. First, it either effectively made unavailable the ambulance that was on standby in case of injury to the president, which had to be used to take the epileptic man to Parkland Hospital. Second, the incident created a distraction and caused Dallas police officer Joe Smith to leave his post at the corner of the depository, making it possible for the men on the grassy knoll to move into position as the parade turned off Main onto Houston. Third, a number of witnesses who wrote to our office found it strange that the woman who was treating the epileptic until the ambulance picked him up, he had bloodied his head slightly in falling, and who had promptly appeared and identified herself as a nurse, was nevertheless dipping her handkerchief in the goldfish pond before wiping his head. Some of these correspondents described the epileptic as a Latin man wearing army fatigues. Fourth, when our office followed up at Parkland Hospital, we found that once the ambulance arrived where the alleged epileptic walked off, refusing to be treated or to identify himself. Okay, let's get back to the text. That description reminded me of the anti-Castro Cuban exiles who were constantly traipsing through Guy Bannister's office on their way to guerrilla training on Lake Pontchartrain. It occurred to me that the dark-complected man who some observers saw might well have been Cuban. Moreover, given what I knew about Guy Bannister's guerrilla training operation and Lee Oswald's proximity to it, the involvement of anti-Castro-Cuban exile guerrillas in the assassination of a president whom they despised for betraying them at the Bay of Pigs in 61 and for ordering their training camp shut down in the summer of 63 seemed a distinct possibility. In fact, the Cubans began to seem more likely suspects than Lee Harvey Oswald himself. In addition to the eyewitness descriptions, other evidence pointed away from Oswald. For example, Oswald's fingerprints were never found on the Mannlicher Carcanal rifle he was alleged to have used. There's an author's note here. Let me read this. About midnight on November 22nd, the FBI took the Mannlicher Carcanal rifle. Excuse me one moment. The FBI took the Mannlicher Carcano rifle, alleged to have been Oswald's, up to the FBI laboratory in Washington, D.C. The Bureau technicians found no fingerprints or even partial prints identifiable as Oswald's. The following day, the Bureau returned the rifle to the Dallas police. Later, the Dallas police excitedly announced that they had found Oswald's palm print on the rifle. The scientific accuracy of this delayed discovery by the Dallas Police Department was reflected in an FBI internal memo dated August 28, 1964, but which was not released until 1968, in which Warren Commission General Counsel J. Lee Rankin is quoted as having said, "Because of the circumstances which now exist, there is a serious question in the minds of the Commission as to whether the palm impression that has been obtained from the Dallas Police Department is a legitimate palm impression removed from the rifle barrel, or whether it was obtained from some other source, and that, for this reason, the matter needs to be resolved." However, the Warren Commission made no effort to resolve it. It presented the palm print in its report as a significant development in the case against Oswald. In 1984, Agent Vincent Drain, who handled the rifle for the FBI, was questioned about the supposed palm print by researcher Henry Hurt. Drain said he did not believe that there ever was such a print. He was quoted as having said, "All I can figure is that it, Oswald's print, was some kind of cushion because they were getting a lot of heat by Sunday night. You could take the print off Oswald's card and put it on the rifle. Something like that had happened." Okay, that is the end of the author's note there. Let me add too that I saw an interview with the director of the funeral home who handled Oswald's funeral, and his name's, I believe it was Paul something, I forget his last name now, but I've also heard Jim Mars talk about this too. This is interesting. The funeral parlor had Oswald in the casket ready to go right before on the eve before this funeral was supposed to take place. The director of the funeral home said that the FBI agents came in and said they needed to wrap up some of their crime work, and they ended up doing a palm print on Oswald in the casket and putting his palm print on the rifle. He said that the agents brought the rifle with them to the funeral parlor and that he had a terrible time trying to get the ink from the prints that the agents had put on him off before the morning before the funeral. Why would he say this? Why would he lie about something like this? That's my question. Anyways, continuing on. Back to the text. A great deal of confusion surrounded this second-rate Italian rifle because there was compelling evidence that it was not the weapon found in the assassin's lair shortly after the assassination. Officer Seymour Weitzman, part of the Dallas police search team, later described the discovery of the rifle on the afternoon of November 22nd. He stated that it had been so well hidden under boxes of books that the officers stumbled over it many times before they found it. Officer Weitzman, who had an engineering degree and also operated a sporting goods store, was recognized as an authority on weapons. Consequently, Dallas Homicide Chief Will Fritz, who was on the scene, asked him the make of the rifle. Weitzman identified it as a 7.65 Mauser, a highly accurate German-made weapon. Deputy Sheriff Roger Craig was also there and later recalled the word Mauser inscribed in the metal of the gun. And Deputy Sheriff Eugene Boone executed a sworn affidavit in which he described the rifle as a Mauser. As late as midnight of November 22, Dallas District Attorney Henry Wade told the media that the weapon found was a Mauser. There is, of course, a significant difference between a first-class Mauser and a cheap mail-order Mannlicher Carcano rifle. It should have been simple to know which weapon had been found. However, to complicate the issue, three empty cartridges from a Mannlicher Carcano rifle were found in the same room as the Mauser. They were near the easternmost sixth-floor window, close together and almost parallel to each other. Although this arrangement made them easy to find, it defied what any experienced user of the rifle knows, that when a rifle is fired, the cartridge is flung violently away. A neat distribution pattern of cartridges, like the one found on the sixth floor of the depository, is virtually impossible. It strongly suggested to me that the cartridges were never fired from the assassin's lair, but were planted near the window, presumably having been fired earlier elsewhere, so that bullet fragments found in the president's limousine could be described as having come from the Carcano rifle. There were other problems with the story that the Mannlicher Carcano had been the murder weapon. For instance, no ammunition clip was ever found. The clip is the device that feeds the cartridges into the rifle's firing chamber. Without such a clip, these cartridges have to be loaded by hand, making fast shooting, such as Oswald was alleged to have done, impossible. The Warren Commission skirted this problem by never confronting that fact. Complicating the matter even further, the Mannlicher Carcano, triumphantly produced as the rifle's assassin's rifle, was found to have a badly misaligned sight. So badly was the sight out of line with the barrel that an adjustment was necessary before government riflemen could complete their test firing. Even so, no rifle expert was ever able to duplicate the feat the government attributed to Lee Oswald. Let me depart from the text and just take a moment here to comment. What he said here is true. I've heard this reported that before the government could try to reproduce what Oswald had done in this incredible physics-defying feat of marksmanship, number one, Oswald was described by his Marine buddies as having been a low to medium at best shooter. A very low-skilled to medium-skilled shooter at best. He was never known to be the marksman on base. He was described as not being interested and not being very skilled at shooting. Number two, they needed three shims. They took three shims because the scope was so out of sight and not zeroed before they could do their tests. How could Lee Harvey Oswald, with this cheap little bolt-on, it's a cheap weapon, it's a terrible weapon to try to assassinate someone with from a distance. It had a reputation known for being harmless. They called it the humanitarian rifle in World War II because it never did anybody harm. So they needed three shims to place under this scope to make it even somewhat close to being accurate. Oh, and number three, the timing of it. It took 2.3 seconds. Even if you kept the rifle butt shouldered to you and didn't drop the rifle from your shoulder to work the bolt and insert a new round into the chamber, it took 2.3 seconds to do that. The official story in the magic bullet theory argue that shots came within 1.6 seconds of each other. Clearly, if a rifle takes 2.3 seconds to fire, work the bolt, and then take aim and fire again, then, well, taking aim out of that, that's even without aiming, it takes 2.3 seconds just to work the bolt, get the empty shell out, put a new round in the chamber, and pull the trigger. 2.3 seconds. The official story holds that it's something like 1.6. So you can't even fire three rounds from this rifle in the timeline of the official story. It would take, 2.3 times 3? It would take almost 7 seconds. 6.9 seconds to fire off three rounds, but the official story holds that it was done in 5 to 6 seconds. So there you go. The story about the rifle, and then, you know, these three shell casings laid out perfectly parallel to each other. It looked like someone just laid them down. When you're shooting and aiming and you're sweeping from left to right on a moving target, and you're working the bolt on three shots, these shell casings are not going to be perfectly aligned in like a 6-inch space all next to each other, right? They're going to be flung all over, and as you're trampling away from the scene of the crime, making your escape, you might kick one, you might step on one, you know, who knows? They're going to be flung all over. Anyways, let me not get too far off track here. Let me continue on with the text. So, no rifle expert was ever able to duplicate the feat of shooting that the government attributed to Lee Oswald. Despite the problems, when the smoke cleared and all the law enforcement authorities in Dallas had their stories duly in order, the official position was that the rifle found on the sixth floor of the depository was the Mannlicher Carcano rifle, which allegedly was linked to Oswald under an alias, and not the Mauser, which disappeared forever shortly after it reached the hands of Captain Fritz. But even this revision of the official story did not explain the third rifle. A film taken by Dallas Cinema Associates, an independent film company, showed a scene of the book depository shortly after the assassination. Police officers on the fire escape were bringing down a rifle from the roof above the sixth floor with tender care, you might give an infant. When the policemen reached the ground, a high-ranking officer held the rifle high for everyone to see. The camera zoomed in for a close-up. Beneath the picture was the legend, "The Assassin's Rifle." When I saw the film, I noted that this rifle had no sight mounted on it. Thus, it could not have been either the Carcano or the vanished Mauser, both of which had sights. I was not surprised to find that this third rifle, like the Mauser, had disappeared, but its existence confirmed my hypothesis that Lee Oswald could not have killed John Kennedy as the American public had been told. Setting aside the evidence of the two other weapons on the scene, the incredibly accurate shooting of an incredibly inaccurate rifle within an impossible time frame was merely the beginning of the feat we were asked to believe Oswald had accomplished. I knew from his fellow Marines' testimony that Oswald was a notoriously poor shot, but this job would have been impossible for even the greatest marksman. From the assassin's lair, the first thing an assassin would see, when attempting to shoot someone in a motorcade below on Elm Street, was an extremely large tree, still luxuriant in the deep south as late as November. This made it unlikely that the first round fired would have hit anything more than a limb or a handful of leaves from the tree below. Moreover, Oswald had been seen in the lunchroom down on the second floor of the depository less than 2 minutes after the shooting. He not only had appeared composed and relaxed, but was drinking a Coke which he had bought from the vending machine. For him to have finished his historic shooting feat, causing 8 wounds in 2 men in less than 6 seconds, then hidden the rifle beneath the pile of boxes, which Officer Weitzman described, and then run down 4 flights of stairs, and then stop for a Coke at the vending machine, all in less than 2 minutes without losing his breath, would have required that Oswald move at nearly the speed of light. Other physical evidence found at the scene pointed away from Oswald as well. A pop bottle that did not have Oswald's fingerprints on it was consequently tossed into the nearest garbage can by Captain Fritz and his investigators. But the most obvious and compelling piece of evidence exonerating Oswald was the nitrate test he was given on the evening of the assassination. Simply put, this test reveals the deposits of nitrate on an individual's cheek when he or she has fired a rifle. The nitrate test results indicated that Lee Oswald had not fired a rifle on November 22, 1963. However, for reasons best known to the government and its investigators, this fact was kept secret for 10 months. It was finally revealed in the Warren Commission report. After going over the government's own evidence, I realized that my earlier conclusion that Oswald had not been the lone killer of President Kennedy was not entirely correct. Clearly, there had been others involved in the shooting, but the truth was that Lee Oswald himself had not shot John Kennedy at all, nor had he even attempted to shoot John Kennedy. It seemed inescapable to me, as a professional prosecutor, that the man damned by the world as the criminal of the century was innocent. Only the truly innocent have to be as thoroughly set up as Lee Oswald obviously had been. The temporary respite from the investigation did not last long. Frank Klein could not stay away from it, and neither could I. One morning, I was in my office reading and rereading a newspaper. I did not hear Frank enter. "I've never seen you so preoccupied," said Frank. "It's not just any paper, son," I had said to him. "This is the front page of the Dallas Morning News for November 22, 1963. "Well, what's got you so hypnotized?" I gestured to the large diagram on the paper's front page, indicating the route of the presidential parade. Have I ever shown you this before?" I asked Frank. He shook his head. I turned the paper around facing his way so that he could read the diagram of the motorcade. It covered almost 5/6 of the front page. "Frank," I said, "I want you to follow the parade route with me. Let's pick it up right here as it comes down Main, approaching Dealey Plaza. Are you with me?" "Yes," he said, his finger following the thick line indicating the motorcade. "And here is where it reaches Dealey Plaza." He stopped. "What's the matter?" I had asked him. "This diagram indicates that the president's parade was supposed to continue on Main Street through the center of Dealey Plaza without even leaving Main." He stared at it in disbelief. "So, what's wrong with that?" I asked Frank. His finger was moving off of Main, inches downward to Elm, until he found the depository area where the president had been shot. "If that was the presidential parade route up there on Main," I finished the question for him, "how did he get way down here on Elm?" Frank looked up at me with a slight frown, and then he looked back at the diagram. He moved his finger back along Main Street to where it reached Houston. "The motorcade turned right on Houston and went down onto Elm Street," he said. "Where the motorcade made that sweeping 120-degree left turn you're looking at, which had to slow the president's car down to about 10 miles an hour." Frank looked up again at the thick line indicating the motorcade route, continuing on Main through the center of Dealey Plaza as it headed for the Stemmons Freeway. "Here on Main Street, continuing through the open meadow," he said, "they couldn't have hit him. Are you telling me that at the last moment they just moved the President of the United States off his scheduled route to here where the depository is?" He pushed his chair back and stood up. "Hell, I haven't read a damned word about that anywhere. How can they keep something like that a secret for 3 years? I leaned back in my chair. "Now you see why I didn't hear you knock when you came in. Where the hell were the Dallas police when they made that last-minute change in the route?" Frank asked. "Where indeed," I said. "And the Secret Service and the FBI. And the city administration of Dallas," he added. Don't they have a mayor over there in that damn place? Yes, they do, Frank. The mayor, when this happened, was Earl Cabell. I buzzed the intercom and my secretary, Sharon Herks, came in. I asked her to take a cab to the public library and find the latest volume of Who's Who in the Southwest. I'm sure you'll find Earl Cabell in there. See if his article indicates any connections with Washington. With Washington? Frank asked me. Of course, I replied. You can't tell me it's possible to hijack the president with the whole world watching unless there's some kind of cooperation between the city administration and the federal government. Frank grabbed the front page of the Dallas Morning News and pointed to the diagram. Hell, he said. Was the Warren Commission blind? Didn't they see this? Oh, I said. Would you like to see the front page that was introduced to the Warren Commission? I pulled open my middle desk drawer and took out a copy of the Dallas Morning News front page that had been introduced as a commission exhibit. I handed it to Frank and lit my pipe. I had hardly taken the first puff on it when he yelled, "Those bastards! They just removed the entire motorcade route from the front page!" That was true. On 5/6 of the Dallas Morning News page, where the diagram of the motorcade route was supposed to be, was nothing but a large square of solid gray. "And this had been printed as an official exhibit by the Warren Commission?" he asked. I nodded. "And just what in the hell are we supposed to call this?" he asked, waving the nearly blank exhibit. I took a puff or two on my pipe. "This is what you call," I replied, "a coup d'etat." An hour or so later, Sharon walked in the door with a large photostat in her hand. "They didn't have anything about Mayor Cabell in the Who's Who," she said. "But there's a lot of stuff here about a General Charles Cabell." I glanced down at the article. Right away it jumped out at me from the page that this Charles Cabell had been the deputy director of the Central Intelligence Agency. Now I found myself looking at that last name with real fascination. It took one phone call to an attorney friend in Dallas to determine that General Charles Cabell was the brother of Earl Cabell, former mayor of Dallas. Now the 11th hour change in the motorcade's route, the president's motorcade route, was even more intriguing to me, and I immediately headed for the public library. Before sunset, I had become the leading expert in New Orleans on General Charles Cabell, who, it turned out, had been fired as the CIA's number two man by President Kennedy. General Cabell had been in charge of the agency's disastrous Bay of Pigs invasion. In the final hours, while Castro's small air force was tearing the landing effort apart, Cabell had managed to get through a call to President Kennedy in an attempt to halt the disaster. Just over the horizon, by something less than happenstance, lay aircraft carriers with fighter planes on their decks, engines warming up. General Cabell informed the president that these fighters could reverse the course of disaster in minutes and secure the success of the invasion. All that was needed was the president's authorization. On the preceding day, Kennedy had assured the assembled media that if anyone invaded Cuba, and the air had become rife with invasion rumors, there certainly would be no help from the U.S. Armed Forces. He flatly turned down Cabell. With that, the invasion's chances sank, as did the general's intelligence career. President Kennedy asked for Cabell's resignation, and the general was subsequently replaced on February 1, 1962, as the CIA's deputy director. General Cabell's subsequent hatred of John Kennedy became an open secret in Washington. In most countries, a powerful individual who had been in open conflict with the national leader who was later assassinated would receive at least a modicum of attention in the course of the posthumous inquiry. A major espionage organization with a highly sophisticated capability for accomplishing murder might receive even more. Certainly a powerful individual who also held a top position in a major espionage apparatus and had been at odds with the departed leader would be high on the list of suspects. However, General Cabell, who fit that description perfectly, was never even called as a witness before the Warren Commission. One reason may have been that Allen Dulles, the former CIA director, also fired by President Kennedy, was a member of the commission and handled all leads relating to the agency. During the 9 years that Dulles had been the CIA's chief, General Charles Cable had been his deputy. That is the end of Chapter 7. And I think we will move on to Chapter 8 and do that too, since we're here and we're only about 45 minutes in. Let me stop before I move on to Chapter 8 and comment a little bit. Now, I think Jim Garrison was an incredible man. He was a patriot. And he had everything to lose, and boy, did he lose. They harangued him on public media and the mass media back then when it was just CBS, ABC, NBC. And boy, they made his life a living hell, and his family suffered for it. And really, he had nothing to gain from it. He didn't gain fame and fortune and riches. He was derided in public. He was ridiculed, his character assassinated. This man is certainly a patriot, and I'm just totally amazed he was able to piece together what he did so soon after the assassination. We're talking 4 years, I think. And, of course, he went to it, you know, the weekend of the assassination, started putting the pieces together and interviewing people like David Ferry. And, you know, there are some people I've seen online all over the internet that like to put down Jim Garrison, but that's just not my hunch on this guy. This man was incredibly brilliant, and I think that this man is a hero, and we ought to remember him as such. We ought to remember this man as the father of the JFK assassination research. That ought to be his legacy. And you know, Jim Mars and a lot of these original researchers are dead and gone now, but I think they would tell you the same. And I don't see very many people go on interviews or go on radio shows these days and talk about Jim Garrison's original research. And I'd be curious to find out what he knew later on. Because he wrote this book, I don't want to say that he wrote this at the end of his life. I'm sure he wrote it sooner, and he ended up dying in 92 or 93, something like that. But this man was incredible, and there are no... I'm sorry, I take that back. There are... citation notes in the back of the book. Now, they're not numbered and cited in the text of the book as you read it, but they are all written in the back. And we're talking, let me go to the final spot here. 292, 308, 308 citations. 308 pieces of information documented and accounted for. 308! That is substantial. This man is a great man. He is a hero. I think we ought to remember him as such. And my God, if we had a country full of people like Jim Garrison, we wouldn't be in the shape that we're in. And I'm curious to think, to find out how close he got. And of course, we're about a third of the way through the book, maybe a fourth. We still got a lot to go. Now, I'm curious if he ever got to fingering Lyndon Johnson as the primary suspect. I wonder if he ever got there. Now, he makes the case that it was not the mob per se, but more the CIA, right? And you see this reflected in Oliver Stone's movie. And there seems to be a lot of evidence that... I've come across in recent years that Lyndon Johnson is the guy behind this. And I know Mike Piper wrote the book Final Judgment about the Mossad connections. And the thing is, when you talk the underworld, you talk the mob, you talk CIA, these things are probably all intertwined to some degree, to where if you go further up the ladder, you go far enough up the pyramid, you might run into the same people, and they may all feed into the same organization at the top. You know what I mean? When you talk about CIA and all these people and the covert operations they were in, like the Bay of Pigs invasion, it gets real murky, and you see all these question marks and smoke and mirrors in the background, and sometimes you miss the obvious truth right in front of your nose the whole time, hidden in plain sight. And I wonder, we'll see when we get there, but I wonder if he ever points a finger at LBJ. LBJ was a one-man criminal cabal, in my opinion, and totally responsible for Vietnam. Profited from the war. Him and his conspirators were making money hand over fist by supplying and logistics companies that were operating in the war, and the guy's just an arch criminal, LBJ, and by some of the information that I've seen, I'm pretty well fully satisfied that it wasn't the mob per se, it wasn't the CIA per se, and Mike Piper, even with the Mossad thing, I don't even think, even though JFK threatened Israel's nuclear weapons programs, that's true, but I don't even think they had more motive than LBJ. LBJ, boy, he was feeling the heat. Him and his criminal associates were likely to be indicted, and this guy, and J. Edgar Hoover, too, was going to lose his job and go down and face the fires. And Kennedy wanted to put away J. Edgar Hoover, because he was operating on this principle that there was a mandatory retirement age of 65. So J. Edgar Hoover had reason to go along with the cover-up and not rock the boat. And Lyndon Johnson did, of course. And then Lyndon Johnson appointed people to the Warren Commission so he could control the investigation and shut down any real, legitimate, independent investigation that someone else initiated. See how that works? Ultimately, I think you get into the weeds with some of the CIA stuff, and it's real murky, so you get real curious, and you start digging and digging and digging and digging up in that murky hall of smoke and mirrors with question marks everywhere about who's in the CIA and the mob, and you forget that, really simply, LBJ is the one who not only profited and gained, but who saved his own arse, saved him from going to prison by taking out Kennedy. And LBJ is the one, along with J. Edgar Hoover, who had the power to cover up the crime, to control the investigation. He is the one. And he, through his Dallas connections, like Clint Murchison, Judge Clark, who else? Billy Celestis, Malcolm Wallace, his personal hitman. LBJ was a puppet or criminal associate of these people in the Texas mob, so to speak. And these are not, you know, Italian gangsters from Chicago per se. These are very powerful, wealthy people, and they had tremendous reason to protect their boy Lyndon Johnson, because he was their connection to controlling D.C. and making money hand over fist. And we'll get into that eventually after the book. And I just wonder. And this is stuff that's all come out in years past. LBJ's widow has spoken and dropped a dime on certain things and connections. And this is 50 years after the fact. This is hindsight, right? And hindsight is damn near perfect in most cases. And I just wonder how close Jim Garrison ever was to sniffing out that trail, if he had any clues or indications that LBJ, to look into LBJ and his connections, not necessarily the Dulles boys, not necessarily the CIA and the mob and Clay Shaw and Marcello and Carlos Marcello and all some of these other murky intelligence kind of circle connections. I think the evidence against LBJ is pretty damning, and it fits. The square peg fits in the square hole. When you look at LBJ, the round peg fits in the round hole, and the triangle peg fits in the triangle hole. When you put LBJ in that little fill in the blank, the story makes sense. It makes a whole lot of sense, in my opinion. We'll see, though. We'll see. Was Jim able to sniff it out? I suppose we will get there. Jim is the father, in my opinion, Jim Garrison, of JFK, what they call conspiracy theory research. And he blazed the trail for all these people. He brought attention to it. And I think he knew his case was weak. I think he knew he only had so many things to work with. He didn't have smoking gun proof. He didn't have direct evidence to secure a conviction against Clay Shaw. I think he knew that. I think he did what he did as a symbolic gesture, kind of a counterpunch, and to put it down on the record that someone was tried and charges were brought against someone for the murder of President Kennedy. And Jim did what he did, and I think he knew that things would grow out of it. People would come forward in the decades to come. Confidences would be said, would be disclosed to other researchers and investigators. And there is recordings of LBJ and John Connolly in particular that I've heard where they're discussing Jim Garrison, and you can tell they are worried. They are concerned. They're dismissive, but at the same time, they're calling each other, spending time talking about it, about this district attorney out of New Orleans. And they're aware of him. They're aware of Garrison. And you know what? I have to say, I think Garrison made the right move. Even though he knew he didn't have a case, even though he probably knew he wasn't going to get a conviction, he brought a level of public consciousness to the whole idea that there's more to the story, that you ought to question the Warren Commission investigation and its conclusions, and that where there's smoke, there is fire. And Jim Garrison is just another one of these people. Over my years and years of research, like Joe McCarthy, for example, that they're onto something and they get harangued and ridiculed in public by the establishment. And if you dig a little deeper, look behind the scenes and hear out their case, it turns out these men are incredibly principled, courageous, brave, American patriotic men who stood against the conspirators, stood against the conspiracy. And I want to take my time with my space to honor them and give them the proper respect. That's how I feel about it. Now, I got way off in the weeds there, going into more things than I should have. And let me stop. I don't want to make this file too long. Let's get into Chapter 8 here. Give me one moment. Okay, Chapter 8. Chapter 8 is entitled Covert Operations. In 1963, Clinton was a rural hamlet in deep south Louisiana. It was a relic of the long-ago time when cotton had been king, a farmer's center where the cotton crops were weighed and buyers bid for them. Clinton was the kind of place whose continued survival had no visible basis. Its importance to the cotton industry had faded. It remained only because it had always been there. But in early 1967, We picked up a lead that made that sleepy town very important indeed. It seemed that back in late summer or early autumn of 1963, Lee Oswald had been seen in Clinton in the company of two older men. The descriptions of these men closely fit Clay Shaw, whose hometown of Hammond we knew was just east of Clinton, and the second man being David Ferry, who had spent a lot of time at Guy Bannister's anti-Castro camp a little farther east on Lake Pontchartrain. It was a slim lead, little more than a whisper in the air, which most law enforcement agencies would have waved away impatiently, but such thin leads were what we had been forced to work with from the beginning. Clinton was a good ways off the beaten path, and I decided that sending Assistant DA Andrew Ciambra by himself from the city might not be the right way to approach this rural town. Ciambra needed someone else with a bit of country background. I called Governor John McKeithen, and he ordered Lieutenant Francis Frugie, a state police officer of Cajun descent, accent included, to join Ciambra in Clinton immediately. We soon had an unexpected strike of good fortune. It developed that Oswald's two older companions had selected the most memorable occasion in decades to show up with Lee Oswald in a country town in the Deep South. For the first time in history, a major voter registration drive supported by the federal government was underway. This effort to register more black voters was strongly supported by the blacks in the town and intransigently opposed by the whites. From sunup to sundown, almost every adult in Clinton was milling about the vicinity of the registrar's office, the blacks to make sure that the whites did not prevent the registration of new black voters, and the whites to make sure that no outsiders had come in to encourage the blacks. It was an occurrence never seen before, and not likely to ever be seen again. In fact, the two witnesses located by Ciambra and Frugie traced their recollection of Oswald's presence with the older men in Clinton to the month of September 1963, because that is when the voter registration drive was underway. A number of Clinton citizens interviewed found the scene unforgettable, because most of the time Oswald was the only white man standing in a long line of blacks. Just as memorable were the two older men who were with Oswald. All of the witnesses described one of the two as wearing a crazy-looking wig and painted eyebrows. There was no doubt that this was David Ferry. Ferry and the other man, who was driving, stayed mainly in the car, which everyone recalled as a large black limousine. One after the other, the Clinton townsfolk described the driver as a tall, very distinguished man. His hair was described as gray or white. Everyone recalled his fancy manners, mentioning that whenever someone passed by the limousine, he nodded politely and said hello. The town marshal suspected that the two might have been sent from the federal government to help black people register. He called in the limousine license plates to the state police and had them checked. The car, it turned out, was registered to the International Trade Mart, which Clay Shaw, obviously the tall, distinguished-looking man, happened to manage. The weather was unexpectedly cool, perhaps an early harbinger of summer's end. However, the temperature of the townspeople was warmer than usual, superheated by the emotion of the situation. Everyone seems to be on the lookout for strangers. To the townspeople who kept glancing in their direction, Shaw and Ferry must have presented an incongruous picture. Ferry, with his wig and painted eyebrows, must have looked like a large, incredibly strange bird. Next to him, Shaw, chain-smoking cigarettes in his imperial manner, must have appeared even more debonair as usual. I'm not familiar with that word. Even more out of place in this small, dusty town. Yet, interestingly enough, Shaw, whose father was an agent for the U.S. Treasury Department, had been born in Kentwood and had grown up in Hammond, just 30 miles east of Clinton. Those townsfolk who were not staring at the two men in the limousine must have stared long and hard at Lee Oswald, and several months later, when the news flashed out that he had murdered the president, a number of them remembered him. Later, at Clayshaw's trial in New Orleans, Edwin McGahee, the town barber, would recall on the witness stand the moment he saw Oswald for the first time. He had just turned off the air conditioning and had opened the door to his shop when a young man walked in. Several months later, when the assassination occurred, he promptly recognized that same young man as Lee Harvey Oswald. McGahee said he gave Oswald a haircut, which took about 15 minutes, and Oswald showed him his Marine discharge card. Oswald then mentioned that he was trying to get a job at the hospital in nearby Jackson. When McGahee informed him that it was a mental hospital, Oswald seemed genuinely astonished, but continued to express interest in the job. McGahee suggested that he see Reeves Morgan, the state representative for the parish. He also suggested to Oswald that he might have a better chance of getting the job if he were a registered voter. Oswald then went to Morgan's house. There was a chill in the air, Morgan recalled, as he sat with Oswald in front of a new fire in the fireplace. He also told Oswald that he would have a better chance for the job if he registered as a voter in the parish. After the assassination, he recognized Oswald from the pictures in the newspapers as the young man who had come to see him about the job. By the time Ciambra and Lieutenant Frugier finished their work in Clinton, they had talked to more than 300 townspeople. After Ciambra returned to New Orleans, I assembled Frank Klein, Jim Alcock, and Lou Ivan in my office. I also called D'Alton Williams in an effort to strengthen our loose handful of men working on the Kennedy case. D'Alton, unlike the other attorneys present, was not primarily a trial lawyer. His specialty was administrative supervision. However, he was exceedingly intelligent. He long had expressed interest in the project, and there were simply no more trial assistants I could remove from the courtroom duty at that time. As they gathered around the long table in the conference room, it occurred to me that for the first time since we had stumbled into this affair, we had what we might be called a team. We listened and asked questions, while Andrew Ciambria reviewed his weeks in Clinton. Alcock wanted to know what conceivable objective could have been accomplished by getting Lee Oswald a job in the state mental hospital in Jackson, if indeed that had been the objective of Shaw and Ferry. Ciambria replied that he had wondered the same thing, remembering Oswald's surprise when the town barber informed him that the place was a mental institution. Ciambra had gone to Jackson to see whether or not Oswald had ever filed a job application there. "And did he?" I asked. Ciambra nodded. "Yes, I found the lady in personnel who interviewed him, but when she went to the files to get a copy of his application, which she remembers him filling out, it was gone. By that time, we had become so used to the systematic disappearance of evidence that no comment was necessary. The fact remained that Oswald had applied for a job at the mental institution, and that would have been all that his sponsors needed for another touch of sheep dipping. A few weeks of menial work there would have been enough to complete the picture of Oswald wandering haplessly from one job to another, each more obscure than the last. With a bit of luck and a little orchestration, it might even have been possible, with a switch of cards from employee to patient, to have the right psychiatrist at Jackson describe the problems he had in treating this strange outpatient named Lee Oswald. Perhaps the most important result of the Clinton work was that we had succeeded in connecting David Ferry and Clay Shaw. knowing that Shaw and Ferry were friends, or even more, that they were jointly engaged in some clandestine association, gave us a better chance to develop information. To investigate Shaw alone, a highly controlled, discreet man with powerful connections, would have been difficult. Now, however, we had found a handle on Shaw. His name was David Ferry. When I showed up at the Pierre Marquette building, Ray Gill came out to his waiting room to meet me. One of the city's best trial lawyers, Ray bowed and extended a welcome in his ornate fashion all the way back to his private office, which looked down on the winding Mississippi River 18 floors below. I was there because David Ferry worked as a part-time investigator for Gill in 1962 and 63. In Gill's office, I waved the small talk aside. "Ray," I said, "I need a favor from you." "No problem," he replied. "My intuition tells me that David Ferry might have charged some long-distance calls on your phone when he was around here." His eyebrows rose up. "Some long-distance calls? God almighty, that man almost bankrupted me." "Can you give me copies of his calls?" I asked. He sent his secretary to search the bills for 1962 and 63. "This is what we have, Mr. Gill," she said when she returned. "You have let him go, or you let him go in January 1964, remember?" "How can I ever forget?" he muttered. He put his finger on the bill for that month. "I told Dave adios. I told him I could put up with his eccentricities, but not his long-distance calls." Gill instructed his secretary to draw a penciled line through every call made by the office, leaving exposed the calls made by Ferry. "They're easy to pick out," he said. "Those cities there didn't have a damn thing to do with this office. You know better than anyone that about 90% of my business is right here in New Orleans." In the course of striking through the office calls, the secretary discovered that the bills for November 1963, the month of President Kennedy's assassination, were missing. She had no idea who had removed them, but pointed out that Ferry still had access to the office files then. That night, I began going through Ferry's long-distance bills for 1962 and 63. The first thing I noticed was their remarkable diversity. The calls were not only to many domestic cities, but to such distant locales as Guatemala, Mexico, and Canada. Just whom he was calling could have been discovered in short order by a federal agency like the FBI with its resources and authority. But it had become apparent that no such agencies were going to be willing to help us out. We had neither the telephone company connections nor the investigative staff to undertake the kind of broad-based, logical approach I would have chosen. Instead, I painstakingly collected and correlated all of the Warren Commission exhibits, listing phone calls made by, to, and otherwise connected with witnesses encountered by the federal investigation. After many evenings of comparing Ferry's long-distance calls to those in the commission exhibits, I made a connection. The local telephone bill indicated that one of Ferry's calls had been made from New Orleans to Chicago on September 24, 1963. This was, according to the Warren Commission's later conclusion, the day before Lee Oswald left New Orleans. The number Ferry called in Illinois that day was WH4-4970. The local phone bill did not identify the recipient. Was Ferry calling, perhaps, to report some intermediary that the sheep-dipping job had been completed, or that the kid is leaving New Orleans, or something like that? In Commission Exhibit Number 2350, I found a call made exactly to the same number in Chicago, Illinois. Under additional information in the Commission volume was listed, person call at 9:09 a.m., credit card used, Kansas City, Missouri, to Miss A. AZ, room 1405. That exhibit did not identify the caller. However, Now, at least, I had someone's name to connect with the number Ferry had called. Some nights later, I located Miss Azy, now spelled A's, in Commission Exhibit Number 2266. There, an FBI report identified her name as Jean Azy of Chicago, Illinois. The FBI report, dated December 4th, 1963, described how she had accompanied Lawrence V. Myers on a business trip to Dallas, Texas, where they arrived the evening of November 20th, 1963, 2 days before JFK's assassination. They checked into the Ramada Motel. The report continued where they spent the night. On November 21st, they moved to the Cabana Motel. Azy then stated, according to the FBI report, that on the evening of November 21st, Myers took her to the Carousel Club where he introduced her to Jack Ruby and, quote, the three of them sat at a table near the doorway and chatted, end quote. Considering that Lee's New Orleans friend, Dave Ferry, had called her Chicago number, I wonder if Miss Azy was later curious when Jack Ruby, her partner in casual conversation, killed Oswald 3 days later. As I searched through the Warren Commission volumes, my confusion about Jean Azy increased. There had been no index to the testimony volumes to indicate that Jean Azy or Jean Azy existed. As for the exhibit volumes, there was no index to indicate the existence of anyone. Then, in an FBI interview with Lawrence Myers, I found that she had become Jean West. I looked at the Warren Commission's discussion of Myers. From his interview, Myers certainly appeared to have been a fairly typical, successful, middle-class businessman. His daughter worked for the government nuclear reactor at Argonne, Illinois. There's an author's note here. Let me read that. Argonne was established in 1946 for scientific research and the development of peaceful uses for nuclear energy. The Argonne National Laboratory is one of the largest scientific research and development centers in the U.S. It is financed primarily by the U.S. Department of Energy. His daughter worked for the government nuclear reactor at Argonne, Illinois, and his son was in Army intelligence. As for Myers' friendship with Jack Ruby, they had happened to meet a few years back, and Myers had grown fond of the future murderer of Lee Oswald. The members of the Warren Commission were evidently satisfied with this testimony. Myers was never asked whether or not he knew David Ferry, nor did he have anything to add about the mysterious Miss Azy. Miss Azy, or Miss West, or whatever her name was, never appeared before the Warren Commission or gave a deposition to the Commission lawyers. I did find a third FBI mention of the mystery woman, this time described as Jean West, in the same Commission exhibit's volume, but it added no illumination. She was not asked whether she knew David Ferry or how he could have access to the very phone number by which Myers also later reached her. Nor did the report reveal a flicker of curiosity about her pre-assassination chat with Jack Ruby. The timing of this woman's meeting, along with Lawrence V. Myers, with Jack Ruby was provocative enough. However, the constant changing of her name, which would confuse anyone who wanted to know about her, confirmed for me that something about her, or her phone number, was suspicious. As I puzzled over this perplexing problem, it suddenly occurred to me that I had stumbled across the use of a message center, a customary intelligence community device to throw off the would-be pursuer of a phone call listing, and in this instance, the message center apparently had resulted in a communication with Jack Ruby. The use of message centers is standard operating procedure for any large government bureaucracy. The message center is so important to the Army, for example, that every unit, from infantry division headquarters all the way down to a company headquarters, has one and would have difficulty functioning without one. In the Army, a unit's message center invariably is located by the nearest road of approach and identified for message carriers by a small sign alongside the road. On the other hand, American domestic intelligence does not like to advertise. So shy is it, in fact, that it claims it does not even exist. Nevertheless, its agents also have a need to communicate, and quite often, especially where the circumstances are delicate, they want to obtain indirection as well, as appears to have been the case where Gene West, who was contacted by David Ferry, ended up the day before the assassination talking to Jack Ruby. The time had come for some brainstorming about clandestine message centers, so I got the team together at the office. I used a blackboard to illustrate the routing I had stumbled across. Ferry calling to West's Chicago telephone. West and Myers flying to Dallas on November 20th. West and Myers meeting with Ruby the day before the assassination. Dalton Williams, our newest recruit, pointed to the diagram. "Your message center idea looks like a probability to me," he said, "but I think the picture can be made clear." We waited for Dalton to continue. "Ruby was from Chicago, wasn't he?" "Sure," I replied, "and so were Gene West and Lawrence Myers. Some of these people must have known each other. That's what makes the message center fit so well." "But there's one problem," said Dalton. "What if we're dealing with the CIA message center here? Dave Ferry obviously didn't have enough status to be deciding what message was going to be sent and where. Remember, we're assuming this communication went right on through to Jack Ruby." "Ruby wasn't that much," interjected Ivan. "That's not Dalton's point," Klein said. "He's saying that someone, like the original instigator of the message, knew what was on the schedule for Ruby." "Right," said Dalton. "So why don't we start off asking ourselves who David Ferry's boss was?" He paused, then asked innocently, "Didn't Guy Bannister used to be the head of the Chicago office of the FBI? "I'll be damned," said Ivan. "Chicago to Chicago all the way through to Chicago." "Do I get a gold star?" asked Dalton, "for figuring out that Guy Bannister probably knew Jack Ruby?" "No," I replied, "because Ruby left Chicago for the Air Force in the late 1940s, and there's nothing to indicate that Bannister knew Ruby that early, but you get a silver star." I walked over to the board, scratched out Ferry's name, and replaced it with Bannister's. "The probability," I went on, "is that with their Chicago connections, they knew some of the same people there." "But how do we get to know for sure?" said Alcock, nodding toward the blackboard, "that our message center up there is the real thing." That was standard Jim Alcock. He was always unhappy with uncertainty. "I don't know," I said. "For now, all we have is a model of a message center. We'll just have to work with that." About this time, in early 1967, we had an unexpected lucky break. Dick Billings, an editor from Life magazine, arrived at the office. He was a slender man with a quick mind and delightful wit. After talking with me at some length, he informed me confidentially that the top management at Life had concluded that President Kennedy's assassination had been a conspiracy and that my investigation was moving in the right direction. Inasmuch as Life was conducting its own investigation, Billings suggested that we work together. The magazine would be able to provide me with technical assistance, and we could develop a mutual exchange of information. The offer came at a good time. I had been wanting to increase my stakeout coverage of David Ferry's home, but did not have the personnel to spare, particularly an expert photographer. We had succeeded in establishing a friendly relationship with the couple who lived directly across the street from Ferry on Louisiana Avenue Parkway. Like him, they lived on the second floor of a duplex and also had a screened porch in the front. I described the situation to the Life editor, and within days a top-flight photographer arrived in town. We promptly installed him at his observation post on the second floor porch across the street. Meanwhile, out at New Orleans Lakefront Airport, Lou Ivan had located a former airplane mechanic of Ferry's named Jimmy Johnson and had persuaded him to go back to work for Ferry, but to keep contact with our office. This airport stakeout on Ferry produced an early dividend. Ferry told Johnson that a package would be arriving for him shortly. A white compact sports car would be parked squarely in front of the airport administration building, with the windows up, but with the door unlocked. Ferry asked Johnson to check every 10 or 15 minutes to see whether such a car had arrived. When it did, he said, Johnson was to reach under the front seat where he would find, taped to the bottom of the seat, a brown package, which he was to bring to Ferry. The car arrived, and Johnson followed the instructions. When Johnson brought the package into the administration building, Ferry took it to the bathroom to examine the contents. He came out full of excitement and announced that he was going to buy a brand new car. This cash, apparently coming to Ferry from a mysterious source, only made more intriguing another fact that Jim Alcock had uncovered. By serving a subpoena on Ferry's bank, Alcock found that Ferry had deposited more than $7,000 cash to his account in the weeks immediately preceding Kennedy's assassination. One other lead about Ferry yielded some provocative information. Ferry, once a pilot for Eastern Airlines, had been investigated by a private detective agency. I obtained a copy of the report. The investigators had maintained a stakeout near his residence and found that Ferry was visited frequently by a man named Dante Maricini. A simple check of the phone book revealed that Dante Maricini resided at 1309 Dauphine Street. This was extremely interesting to me because right next door was the home of Clay Shaw. I wondered who else might be living next door to Shaw. Reaching for the red book, which lists individuals by address, I found that also living at 1309 Dauphine Street was a man named James Llewellyn. I recalled from earlier research that James Llewellyn had once shared an apartment with David Ferry in the vicinity of Kenner, a New Orleans suburb. Now I found myself looking at two unfamiliar names, Maricini and Llewellyn, both of whom had in the past been associated with Ferry and both of whom now live next door to Clay Shaw. That was something to think about. Sometime later, I came across the name of Dante Maricini again. I had wanted to talk to individuals at the Riley Coffee Company who worked with Lee Oswald, or at least a level immediately above him, so I sent Frank Klein over to the company to get their names and respective positions. He returned rather quickly. "They're all gone," he said. Anyone who ever had a connection with Lee Oswald left the Riley Company within a few weeks after Oswald did. He laid a sheet of paper in front of me. "Here are the names and the new jobs." I glanced down at the list. One name jumped right out at me immediately, Dante Maricini. He had begun work at the Riley Coffee Company on exactly the same day as Oswald. Several weeks after Oswald's departure, Maricini also left the coffee company and began life anew at the Chrysler Aerospace Division at the National Aeronautics and Space Administration, NASA, on the eastern side of New Orleans. I then noticed that Alfred Claude, who hired Oswald for Riley, had also gone to work for the Chrysler Aerospace Division. Then I saw that John Branion, who had worked with Oswald at the coffee company, had left for a job at NASA. At just about the same time, Emmett Barbie, Oswald's immediate boss at Riley, left the coffee company and also inaugurated a new career with NASA. After seeing what happened to all of these men associated with Oswald at the coffee company, and after seeing Maricini's name again, my curiosity about 1309 Dauphine Street returned. I called Lou Ivan in and asked him to find out if James Llewellyn, David Ferry's former apartment mate who now resided at 1309 Dauphine Street, had been as fortunate as some of the workers at Riley had been. It took Ivan a couple of days, but he came back with a now fairly predictable piece of information. Llewellyn had gone to work for Boeing out at NASA. Lou and I kicked this interesting situation around a bit, and then we both became curious about what had happened to Melvin Coffey, who had accompanied David Ferry to Texas on the eve of the assassination. Ivan was back the next day. Melvin Coffey had been hired by the aerospace operation at Cape Canaveral. Perhaps it was mere coincidence that all these men associated with David Ferry, Clay Shaw, and Lee Oswald ended up working for NASA, but I doubted it. I knew by now that when a group of individuals gravitated toward one another for no apparent reason, or a group of individuals inexplicably headed in the same direction as if drawn by a magnetic field, or coincidence piled on coincidence too many times, as often as not, the shadowy outlines of a covert intelligence operation were somehow becoming visible. Okay, that's the end of chapter 8. That'll be the end of this particular part 4. I'm sorry for the choppiness in my reading. Changing positions and holding the book differently and stumble upon words and get ahead of myself. And it sounds bad, but anyway, that's the end of this segment. We will be back next time with part 5. And we will be moving on to chapter 9 in the book. And I hope you guys enjoy, and I hope you find this as intriguing as I do. Until next time, take care, God bless, bye-bye.